Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, Radeon Vega Frontier Edition, benchmarks. Seasonic's got an affordable power supply with a 10-year warranty. The token ring might replace your credit cards and your two-factor authentication. And some television recommendations from Robert Herron. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 422, recorded on July 6, 2017. Radeon Vega Frontier Edition, benchmarked. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most engaging, and yes, even the most delightful news about PC hardware. We love gaming, we love desktops, we love smartphones, we love mobile, and goodness, we might even on the bad days love the Internet of Things. Joining us today, my partner in crime on AVXL, Mr. Robert Herron of HerronFidelity.com. How are you, sir?
I am awesome. Thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, my goodness. It is a fantastic time. If you have been thinking, not just because, you know, Prime Day is coming, you know, which the Wirecutter pointed out, they found, I think, 64 out of nearly 8,000 Prime deals that were actually deals by their standards. But all it takes is one good price and a good TV, and Prime Day seems kind of amazing. But there's actually a solid $700 4K UHD TV right now.
I would say so.
Worth buying.
That the TCL's P series has been just getting better and better reviews as time goes on. Mm-hmm. It delivers just about everything you want in an affordable package in terms of 4K resolution, which is a given nowadays, and anything at 50 inches and larger. But more importantly, it has a wide color gamut support system built into it, so it can take advantage of those formats like HDR10 and Dolby Vision that utilize a color palette that far exceeds what regular HD and Blu-ray video is doing to provide more lifelike, realistic imagery that you get off the screen. That TV is delivering it to you for, I think it's a 50-inch screen there, or 55 for...
55-inch screen.
Terrific price. Gamers are also reporting that the lag times on that system are pretty good. But overall, I think most important to me for that is an interface driven by a third party, but someone who's been around the block a couple times in terms of having a Roku TV built into that delivers not only the interface you use for streaming your video and content, but also it actually, they control the entire interface of the TV in terms of menus and other things. And compared to just about any other TV you're going to look at nowadays, most in terms of the software built into them are abandoned almost immediately. They're pushed out the door, and unless there's a serious error or security issue, they're never updated again, or they're only updated to add advertising hooks into the damn thing you already bought, or some other less than optimal reason.
I mean, you and I were arguing about this.
But I like having the idea of Roku driving the back end. Provide me something the equivalent of maybe their Roku Ultra, or another one of their 4K streaming devices that gets you know, Netflix and Amazon delivering there, and others like Vudu and others supporting high dynamic range 4K content delivery, all kind of built in with a TV that includes some pretty good picture performance. As far as a direct lit LCD system with local dimming, or is it edge lit? It has to be direct lit, I would think, for the number of zones.
It's direct lit.
For the zone control they're claiming, it has to be. Edge-lit systems, it doesn't matter who's making it.
Right.
Generally,
full-array LED backlighting, 72 local dimming zones on that 55-inch screen.
You can't claim anything like that without direct lighting. If you try to do it through the edges, you almost end up with like two zones of backlight control. In some cases, a little bit more, but otherwise. But that's the other thing, too. That remote that it comes with is similar to the premium remote shipped with Roku boxes in terms of having a voice command where you can do search and other things, as well as an 1/8-inch headphone jack that you plug your favorite pair of headphones into, or the earbuds that are included. for private listening. Those kind of deals with enough of the right things put together are the new bottom point in terms of where you should be looking. If you can't afford the $2,000 55-inch OLED, then I would be looking here. I'd be looking at great value, brightish and colorful-ish 4K panels from makers like TCL and companies like Hisense too. I'm looking forward to see what they have coming up in terms of their D series and beyond. It's going to be good. There are some solid values out there. And we were also talking about too, the LG introduced this week their availability and shipping of their W series wallpaper panel.
Right.
In the 77-inch size. That was what was new this week. I believe the 55 and the 65 have been out there for a while now. Now they are actually shipping a 77-inch panel. In terms of two retail channels where you can, if you can walk into the store with the cash, you can probably get one. although you probably want to call ahead and just confirm that they actually can get you one in stock.
Yeah.
But
they're
still,
for sale. They send you to Best Buy. Best Buy tells you to call the local store.
That design.
You know, it's I mean, like the 65-inch has been shipping for a few weeks. That's that $8,000 65-inch version.
No other company has taken just the panel out of a display system raw. I mean, like no support, no nothing.
Right.
And offered that to you in a way that you can stick it to the wall with a magnetic mount. I mean, you can't do it any thinner with any current technology short of projection. And
how thin is it? Is it 2 millimeters or 5 millimeters?
The panel itself is like 2 millimeters thick. And then you have to attach it to this bracket so it doesn't fall off the wall. But it's like, it's all, the whole thing weighs like 26 pounds at 77 inches. And the panel as it is kind of flexible. So you literally can pull up on a corner of it when it's on that mount. It's not just hanging there by magnets only. It's actually hooked in, but the corners to hold it to the wall are magnetic along the sides. So when you grab, say, that bottom left or right corner, you can pull that up with your finger and it will flex just fine. I wouldn't be doing this regularly, but it's made to. And to connect it and to drive it is that big sound bar at the bottom. That is a required component in this setup. You can't have one without the other. It is a very nice soundbar, and it has an 82-inch ribbon cable going to it that you can literally stick to the wall and paint over. And it supplies, in my opinion, some of the best audio you're going to get out of a TV. But those two go together. You can't have one without the other, or you're hiding that soundbar just to have that panel. That's the only trade-off at the moment. I could imagine you would see a version of this that just has a more condensed breakout box with no audio at all.
Right.
That would be my choice. And that would definitely save some bucks off the total cost of it, especially if you're adding this to a room that already has great audio through a 5171 or beyond setup.
Mm-hmm. It's a pretty big, and when you take a look at it, it's you know, we were joking about it back at CS. It's like Kylo Ren's helmet. It's very sort of stylized. It's got, you know, lots of silver striping on it, or, you know, what looks like cooling fins, which I think takes away from the whole, we created this sort of portal into another universe with our, you know, 2 millimeter thin screen, and now we are going to put this giant box underneath it that you have to have if things can operate. Still beautiful. I mean, let's talk for a second about...
On the commercial side of their OLED panels, they do offer a version that is literally a breakout box attached to a similar OLED panel in design, but it's more for commercial installation and use. Signage, a very nice piece of signage, but that actually has a breakout box that I really would love to see somehow incorporated back to the consumer side of it. But still, I have sat in a room with that setup, with that soundbar, and it does sound fantastic, especially in the sweet spot. If you're in those three seats right in front of that TV, the Dolby Atmos compatibility, granted, it's literally a two-channel system with simulated height channels and all of it, but it worked really well. And four TV speakers, I have no complaints about what that comes with. It's just a complete package. And hey, look, if you don't want that soundbar, you can eventually be able to hopefully step back to some of the other models with more traditional framing and buy a set that you can mount to the wall. Otherwise, it won't be that flat panel design, but panel only design. But that'll be the big question I have going forward is what will be the cost of step down 77 inch panels, or will there even be anything that migrates beyond the W series in a 77 inch mm-hmm. size, except for premium partners like Sony and others who are utilizing the LG panels. I don't think there are that many of the 77 inch panels to be suddenly throwing these into cheaper series per se, at least initially outside of the W. So we'll see. So
when we talk about part of the reason the W7 is so fabulous is LG's work on OLED screen technology. Has it, in your opinion, is OLED ahead of QLED, the Samsung's quantum dot technology? Is it a matter of personal taste? Is it something you can benchmark when you throw the test machines on it? I mean, can you get the colorimeter on it, be like definitively say one of these does a better job of representing the accurate or true HDR color range?
This shade of red or this shade of green.
Is there any point to that?
I would say the honest answer is not really. When you also factor in the luminance output of these displays, and one of the things that we all love OLED for is its ability to be pitch black or perfectly black in a room with good light control. And that ability to generate contrast, even if it can't exceed 1,000 nits, it really doesn't matter in a sense, because it's making even old content look more contrasted by the very fact that it has a pure black level in terms of displaying imagery. That's something you get on LCDs if you are seated just right. But if you so much as shift your head left or right, that will change in terms of the perceived contrast level. The LCDs generally will lose contrast, some more so than others, as you move off axis. And that brightening of the black, making black more gray, makes color desaturated, and it loses some of the pop in the picture. So as far as wide-angle viewing, you can't really beat OLED at this point. I'm not saying it's perfect off-axis viewing with an OLED. Things do change, especially the grayscale on an OLED. If you put up a gray pattern, and I don't care what OLED you look at, if you put up a nice step grayscale pattern and move left and right, you will see some shifting in terms of green fringing and pink or red fringing as you move around. And they're not perfect panels, but compared to an LCD, that wide-angle viewing is far superior. As far as LCDs go, they are capable of generating double, triple the luminance levels. So you can produce an extraordinarily bright picture while maintaining super saturated color. And that's what you can't currently do with OLEDs. If you try to drive an OLED to 1,000 nits currently using that RGBW pixel design, you're just blasting more white light into it, and that desaturates. You can't do that. And they know you can't, so it'll never do that. So each has its trade-offs, but if you've ever just looked at any content, doesn't matter if it's standard def, high def, 4K, whatever, on an OLED, everything just looks more contrasted because of that super dark black level. And that's an initial advantage that's really hard to beat. What the LCD folks are moving toward is a per-pixel OLED-like display. The next generation we'll see it in CES of 2018 will be the photoemissive quantum dot technology, where instead of having a separate sheet or a tube in front of the lighting system that has the quantum dot material impregnated in it, they get rid of all that, move the quantum dot material directly into the color filter. You simplify the design, you get more light transmissivity through the panel, and you're then generating at least two of the three colors closer to the surface of the panel. That will produce better off-axis viewing, and they're claiming 2 to 2.5 times the light output for similar LEDs that they're currently using. So, but we're not going to see that till next year. Hopefully sooner than later, but that's coming. And eventually, you'll just have a simple swap out between the OLED materials versus quantum dot materials that can be stimulated directly with electrons or electricity to emit light directly. When that happens and they can create formulas that can be substituted in the current manufacturing for OLEDs, OLED might go into a weird like plasma state where it's still considered a classic, but nobody wants it because it can't generate the light potential that will have in a couple of years from now from emissive quantum dot materials. But the chemistry is not quite right yet. They have no way of directly substituting these things at scale. If you are a chemist in the world or you're thinking about chemistry, believe me, when it comes to display systems, the light and physics folks all bow down to the chemistry folks, because none of these chips or any of this technology gets done without chemistry. And that's where the current effort's being put. And as soon as they have a formula that can be substituted cheaply, or at no cost or lower cost, boom.
Right.
We'll have per pixel illuminated displays pushing 2,000-3,000 nits. That's going to happen in, say, 3 to 5 years. And yummy.
That's going to be pretty bright.
I'll jump off my tangent there.
Oh, my goodness. $2,500 4K projectors are showing up. The Epson Home Cinema 4000, Optomus UHD 60, and probably the cream of the crew because of some of the added features beyond the pixel shifting to get to 4K. Optoma's UHD 65. Won't get too deep into those, but it's amazing how fast. And technically, these are not true 4K projectors, right? Because they are using the magic of little tiny dots or little tiny mirrors moving fast to create more pixels than are actually available in the chip for the display.
True. But
it's amazing how fast the price on quality 4K UHD experiences is dropping in projector land. So
all the projectors you just listed are all, more importantly, featuring DCI color expression in terms of a more saturated palette. They go beyond just HD color. Like most current projectors are just limited, laser or otherwise, unless you're paying bucks. You're dealing with the old school color palette processing these 4K formats. These projectors that you've listed are all providing beyond HD color. And that, to me, regardless of the resolution output, is key. And on top of that, they're all going beyond 1080p. In the case of the DLP part, technically, that is a 4K display. That is able to address all 8 million plus pixels of a true 4K image independently.
I'm sorry. I keep thinking I always find it tough because, like, when you think of a 4K display, I think, like, I want, an actual 8 million pixels, one pixel or one mirror or one dot for each individual. But
consider that the last generation of the 1080p rear projection TVs that existed, those were all in a similar boat. They were all half-resolution 1080p imagers that could address multiple pixels, or two, plus an off-state. So all of those 1080p chips back in the day were literally half-resolution, and now they've simply bumped that up to say, hey, we can do the same thing with 4K by just having – we only need half the mirrors. In the case of the LCD technology, though, they're actually shifting it a different way, where they're not able to achieve full 4K resolution, but it's getting up there. It's beyond 1080p, and I haven't measured or tested it, but something you could think of it as like 3K instead of true 4K, like you're able to get out of a DMD system on a chip like the Optoma HD 60 or 65. So there is no loss of resolution on the HD 60 or 65 in terms of 4K input, and you're getting DCI color on all these systems. So
it's pretty amazing. Like you're looking at a
DCI-ish.
Epson's three chip. Yeah. Epson's three chip LCD on the Cinema 4000. You're looking at like, 3,500, 5,000 hours of lamp life in eco mode, the Optoma UHD 60, UHD 65. They're claiming 4,000 hours of lamp life in bright mode, and up to 15,000 hours of lamp life in dynamic mode, which is amazing, especially given the UHD 65, or the UHD 60 is running 3,000 lumens. the UAC 65, which has a more sophisticated color wheel and frame interpolation, Optoma is what they call pure motion. So it's going to give you a better experience when you're watching movies and such. It's pretty amazing to realize just exactly how far projector technology has come. And, you know, I'll admit, like, I have trouble looking at 4.15 million mirrors and coming up with 8K, but I will once again defer to the fact that the mirrors are considerably faster than the eyeballs.
Oh, that Texas Instruments DLP technology is long established. Right. All commercial cinemas that feature laser projection are using full resolution, three sets of these chips per projector. In the case of a Dolby Cinema theater, there are two projectors combined to deliver extra brightness in case you want to do a 3D presentation or just run the projectors at a little lower duty rate, so to speak. Right. But you're talking like there is no – given the performance of their mirror technology to be able to address a couple of different pixels specifically and the speed it's able to do it, I really don't see a trade-off there. And in the case of a three-chip system versus single chip, you have things like other things like convergence issues where the three-chip system has to put the red, the blue, and the green image overlaid perfectly. If there's any distortion to that or if it's offset a little bit, you get fringing and other artifacts that reduce perceived detail and things like that. Things that go away in a single chip system, I will always prefer a three chip system just for the general brightness improvement, being able to process red, blue, and green independently. There's a lot of benefits to having a three chip system, but for affordability, and we're talking stuff $2,000 and under, or say $2,500 and under, that's where the single chip DLP systems can get you the resolution and the color at a price point that was just not possible even a couple of years ago. And I, what I'll be curious to see too is what kind of lag time these projectors are delivering. Are they, you don't hear a lot about projector folks focusing on lag unless they're questioned about it in a review or something like that. So I hope more people are actually testing that to make sure at least there's a game mode for those things, as they can often get into some, anytime you enable any kind of video processing, it's going to introduce some kind of lag. So at least if there's a mode related to that sort of playback that would help folks, that's the way it should be.
Oh my goodness. Switching gears a little bit. We should talk about, Ryan had his hands on it last week. Before we talk about, Radeon Vega Frontier Edition, something that's probably worth paying attention to, especially if you've been holding off on a system build, is that RAM prices are definitely increasing. Obviously, PCs, laptops. There's a huge drive in China to differentiate cell phones by throwing a huge amount of RAM on Android-based phones. For example, the OnePlus 5 is carrying in its maxed-out version, the $539 version, 128 gigabytes of RAM and 8 gigabytes. 128 gigabytes of storage, 8 gigabytes of RAM for the chipset, that A35 chipset. But, you know, you're also talking about cars, SSDs. There is a tremendous amount of RAM consumption going on right now. So, A, RAM prices are going up. B, Samsung says, quote, it will invest $26.1 billion by 2021 in its existing plant in Pyeongtaek, South Korea, to expand its semiconductor fabrication capacity. It's already, I think, the single largest plant in the industry, and it's making 64-layer fourth-generation V-NAND flash chips. So Samsung's looking to expand. There's so much demand. And what's also interesting is it looks like there have been some accidents as of late that have decimated RAM production over at, or hit, taken a hit on RAM production over at Micron. Jeremy Hellstrom over at PCPer wrote up, quote, sadly, not the NAND gates. Even if some of these RAM rumors are false, we are in for shortages. So, you know, again, Samsung investing to increase capacity. But DRAM Exchange said there was a nitrogen leak in one of Micron's fabs, which may have killed as many as 60,000 wafer starts, or about 5.5% of the RAM available by the end of the month. Micron says, nope. There was an incident, but there was no real impact to the business or the employees. You know, that particular fab produces LPDDR4, which is already in short supply, Jeremy notes. The other thing that's interesting is SK Hynix and Toshiba's 3D NAND production is below expectations, and that the supply of NAND for iPhones may fall short by as much as 30%. So, you know, this is something that's going to be impacting, I think, obviously RAM availability, the pricing of RAM over the next few months, not necessarily in, just in like desktop or laptops, but in all the devices that consume RAM. And more and more and more of those are showing up each and every day. And, you know, at least with the Internet of Stuff, it's usually very small amounts of RAM. But it was interesting to take a look at those stories and see that.
I was going to say, for the last couple of systems I built, I've been lately building, going through Intel Nook boxes. Built about three of them in the last 6 months. And every single time, I'm putting DDR4 RAM chips in these things, similar to notebook style RAM. And every time I go to build a new one, so the price has gone up another 10% or 20%. So
yeah,
it's almost effectively doubled. That's now become like, I'm like, why is the memory so expensive for this one component? You just clearly notice the price jacking up, and
yeah,
it's affecting my bottom line. So, or at least out of pocket.
I don't think it's going away anytime soon. The price increases. So, we'll see. You know, it'll be interesting to see how it impacts or does not impact, you know, sales in the fourth quarter. But the other thing I mentioned,
just for Intel Nooks in general, unless you need graphics, discrete graphics for something in particular that can't be done with the Intel part, those are just solid systems you can put together in like 5 minutes. I mean, it is just a fantastic way to build out a quick CPU that runs on less than 20 watts of electricity, generally speaking. it's really hard to ignore the efficiency of that and how small, and those boxes also come with mount brackets for attaching to the back of a computer display. So add a 1 foot HDMI cable, done. Pretty convenient overall for a small PC system using effectively like notebook style components. And the only thing you really need to add is OS, RAM, and the hard drive or an SSD.
Well, it's also helpful that the notebook GPUs now are very, very close to desktop GPU performance, which means you're not really getting the same kind of massive penalties as you would have a couple, even like a year or two ago. About a year ago at this point.
I have friends with really nice gaming notebooks, but as nice as they are, I would still rather have discrete desktop graphics every time for PC gaming, at least. So.
At least you have to carry that machine around.
Speaking
of discrete, of DeGroot's graphics, I am Groot. The Radeon Vega Frontier Edition, 16 gigabyte, air-cooled review. You know, I feel like we talked a bunch about this last week, but, you know, let's go into it in a little more detail because Ryan got to run all of his benchmarks. This isn't a gaming card. Quote, it's a card for creators that game. Similar to the GTX Titan, Titan X, and Titan XP, except that those were delivering superior gaming performance. Ryan took a bunch of time to up on PC Pro to sort of walk through answering questions before you ask, where he points out that, you know, AMD does not consider this a gaming card. It's, you know, it's kind of a prosumer card. You know, the driver isn't optimized for gaming, you know, how it's targeting professional level applications. That said, that's the rumor, but the reality, AMD says, is the driver has all the gaming optimizations that the other Radeon drivers would include up until at least the driver branching that he talks about in the article. You know, it's some interesting stuff going on, like, you know, you didn't, you know, why didn't you test it overclocked? Why didn't you turn up the fan speed? You know, didn't you have it in game mode? Basically a large kind of collection of things that people were concerned about in the test results, because you basically tested the card live. And, you know, this, of course, is this, you know, professional grade card or professional card that bridges to the incredibly expensive cards. And the RX Vega, which is the like the consumer version, should be clocked higher. It may have a better cooler. That, of course, would help with performance. But when you take a look at the card, You know, I'll be curious to see like what happens, you know, with driver evolutions and stuff. But the gaming benchmarks put the Vega Frontier Edition, quote, somewhere between the GeForce GTX 1070 and the GTX 1080. That said, it's about 25 to 45% faster than an R9 Fury X card. Then from a professional workload angle, I'm going to quote Ryan here. The Radeon Vega Frontier Edition fares much better, splitting the line between the features, performance, and support that NVIDIA offers between its GeForce and Quadro products. So a P5000 Quadro card will offer performance that exceeds Vega FE, but at more than or at double the price. And to put that price in perspective, the Vega Frontier is $1,000 air-cooled, $1,500 water-cooled. You know, so it's going to be slower than a Titan XP, which, depending on where you're searching for it and what kind of state it's in, is going to be $1,500 to $2,000. So it's slower than a Titan XP in gaming, but it'll hang pretty well with a Titan XP in spec view perf. It's a little bit behind in Luxmark, but a little bit faster in the OpenGL-based Cinebench R15 test. So, you know, the Vega FE is an interesting card. It is not a pure gamer's card. It is a creator's card for people that also want to be able to game, or probably, you know, more likely a creator's card or professional, you know, a professional's card that can also be used to run so many of the 3D models that are new, the kind of the, you know, Unreal-based stuff that people use to demonstrate products.
I agree with that, especially at that price point, too. I mean, that's the big one. When you're spending that much on a graphics card, that seems more optimized for content development and operating complex 3D models and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, because I mean, man, if you have $1,000 for a graphics card for gaming, what would you buy? Right. And probably I'll be honest with you, the fact that that's hitting like at least, you know, greater than 1060 speeds, 1070, 1080 range. Yeah. Excellent.
It's a pretty good card. But
still. There's a VIG for that one.
Ryan had also pre-ordered a bunch of cards to make sure he got one delivered to do benchmarking as early as possible. So he did some Radeon Vega Frontier Edition Crossfire testing. You know, the only professional test that scales with multiple GPUs is Luxmark. You know, and running two cards basically boosted Luxmark by 2.14 times. But SpecView Perf and Cinebench don't use multiple GPUs, so they weren't impacted on it. But when you take a look at, you know, Crossfire on the Vega, it's not spectacular. Scaling at 2560 by 1440 was kind of miserable, as little as a 20% improvement by adding the second card on The Witcher 3. When you get up to 4K, the scaling gets better. You're looking at anywhere from 54% to 84% by adding a second card. It really depends on the game. Hitman in DX12, Ryan writes, was the outlier with zero scaling, indicative of the continued concerns over the new API and the pressure it puts on developers going forward, which is a polite way of saying, you know, there's some work to be done in terms of support for the card or within the developer community. So, you know, the Ryan also noted the time frame variance of a lot of the results are higher than they want to see. For example, Witcher 3, tremendous scaling in performance running the Radeon Vega Frontier Edition in Crossfire. But then there's frame-to-frame variances above 10 milliseconds, and that's not good for the experience. So, you know, at this point, you know, this is probably one of the last things that AMD is going to sort of get serious about, debugging and improving, because there's going to be so few people actually running a pair of these $1,000 cards in Crossfire. You know, basically,
but if you take that architecture forward to other chipsets and other things.
Well, this is the first of the Vegas. I mean, you know, when you're looking at this, like, you know, I'm going to quote Ryan here. With two Radeon Vega Frontier Edition cards in Crossfire, AMD is having trouble keeping pace with a single GeForce GTX 1080 Ti. So NVIDIA is still definitely in the lead at this point.
You know, it's my 1060. You know,
yeah,
the value.
Well, I had to pick up a 1070 recently, and you know, it's because that's the that was the least powerful or least expensive GPU I could get to drive an 8K monitor. You know, I have all the display ports now. I have an amazing collection of display ports, but it's worth taking a look. Tremendous number of benchmarks. You know, GeForce GTX Ti is like running, I want to say, 30% faster than the Radeon Vega FE and Crossfire. You know, the later Radeon Vega cards that are gaming oriented, I suspect we'll see a different level of performance on that, but we will not know until they ship.
Dun, 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 dun.
If you're curious what the Frontier looks like, Ryan, I believe Ryan actually popped the cooler off of the Beast to get a look at what was going on inside of that.
Void that warranty. Card,
GPU. Well, you know, he owns several of them at this point. I have to admit, I really like the styling of this card. You know, the big blue box with the yellow logo and the fan on the side of it. I don't know if we can get that. There it is.
Once it's installed in my opaque black case. The only thing I could ask for is I need to do and check out and find smaller DisplayPort cables. It seems like the connectors on most of these cables you find are just the biggest, chunkiest thing coming off the back of that card. And I'm not seeing anything that's just like, you know, like an ultra slim. I haven't looked very hard either. So I will get on that. And
it's early yet. It's early yet. Goodness. So that's pretty much the story of where Vega Frontier Edition is at this point. Most people are not going to be buying this card. Most people are not doing, you know, serious engineering or CAD or architecture or stuff like that. Interesting observation from Passmark Labs, the benchmarking people. Basically, they said AMD's share of benchmarks has bounced back this year, rising from 18.1% at the beginning of the first quarter to 26.2% at the beginning of the third quarter, while Intel's share has dipped to 73.8% at the same time, which is to say, you know, the majority by a significant margin. But the idea is essentially that, you know, the improvement, or basically there's people buying AMD Ryzen systems and they're gaming on them. So,
you know, this is a big deal. Interested to see a benchmark based upon Bitcoin mining for the Vega chip, considering how many of the other AMD ATI parts have been popular in the past.
I'm going to direct you to a synthetic benchmark.
I would like to see.
We should get you on the PC Per podcast so you can talk to Alan Melventano and Ryan Shrout about Bitcoining and the optimizations in GPUs, because there's several GPUs have come out recently that have been optimized for Bitcoining, which is a wild concept. But the kind of the big story out of this is AMD's had a really good 2017, and their CPU, their market share has gone up for the first time since 2006, which is good to see because it's been relentlessly dipping for over a decade at this point. So Ryzen seems to be doing its job, at least for the early adopters that run benchmarks.
Some folks mentioned a quick thing about DisplayPort in general. Some folks mentioned that there is mini DisplayPort, which I think on the graphics card itself, I think would be much better than having a full size port. At least for the setups I deal with, it's just a giant chunk of plastic coming off the back that I'm always like, if nothing ever touches it, great. However, I wish that interface were a little smaller, and I think it'd be a little more convenient for just routing and other things. So, anyway.
It's done with my
DisplayPort rant, and I appreciate the heads up on the mini.
DisplayPort rage. Seasonic's been overhauling their PC power supply lineup. Lee Garbutt's got a great review up of the Focus Plus Gold FX 650-watt power supply unit. This is a $90 650-watt 80 plus gold power supply with a 10-year warranty for $90. The plus gold FX lineup goes from 550 watts at $80 to 850 watts for $110. 10-year warranty.
Nice.
You know, multi GPU support. You know, it's fully modular cables, micro tolerance load regulation at 1%. It's only 5.5 inches deep. fluid dynamic bearing cooling fan, Haswell support. It's a pretty impressive, power supply for the price. Editors,
I want to say I'm using something similar in terms of a modular power supply, about that same wattage, with a high-end graphics card, a couple of storage devices, plus the CPU. And I doubt I ever come close to needing all of it. But and that includes I think I have dual power connections going into this graphics card too, and so it's not like a total wimp. But anyway, for $90, 10-year warranty. What the hell?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty good deal.
I've seen more expensive things fail sooner.
This is true. 80-plus gold certified for high efficiency, excellent voltage regulation, excellent AC ripple and noise suppression. Looks like a really quality product for the money, and worth taking a look at if you are building a system and in need of a power supply. That's the Focus Plus Gold power supply units from Seasonic. Andy Rubin's Essential phone did not ship in June.
Aww.
And kind of a heartbreaker.
What does that mean?
Right? So they've been accepting pre-orders, right? So Andy Rubin was like, I'm going to build the phone that I want to see for Android. Andy, of course, being kind of the father of Android, as it were. Essential started pre-selling phones. And announced at the Recode conference in May. Andy Rubin said it would start shipping in 30 days. And Essential is not shipping yet and is not talking about it. They've been taking orders for an unlocked version of the phone on the website. They plan to offer the phone through Sprint. The only, quote, U.S. carrier that has said it will sell the device, says the Business Insider. And then Sprint told the Business Insider last week that the Essential phone is expected to debut this year, but didn't know exactly when. So hopefully this is going to ship sometime soon rather than just eventually. It's tough because this is, it's frustrating when you see a kind of a high profile product that is shipping late. I'm curious to see when it ships.
I love that somebody could come up with a new phone design, but what it really comes down to for me, at least on Android, is the ability to dodge the carrier specific updates if it's possible. And that's really not from most folks. And I can't tell you how much better like Android 7 is compared to 6. And yet how many people in the Android community are running 7? And very few. Unless you have a state-of-the-art brand new phone right from the carrier, you're probably not. And that to me is the biggest problem with Android. Hopefully the new O series or whatever, the O software, can make those updates from the carriers a little more efficient and quicker. But man, this always is what drives me. If you're on Android, this is what drives me toward Google phones and the like that are unlocked and you get the, right. At least for a couple of years, you get updates directly from the Google themselves. And again, everyone with an Apple phone is just laughing. It's I have an original Apple 4 phone. I have a 5S. Mm-hmm. They all have been updated to whatever the latest is for those particular platforms. The 4 doesn't get updates anymore, but that 5S is running the latest software. And I don't even have to think about it. And Android
needs
a good
point. I mean,
it's a carrier.
It's a beautiful looking phone.
Everyone wants to put their brand on their crap.
Yeah.
Usually with the worst software possible. And then at least in terms of the manufacturers, they never offer just pure Android as an option. It should be the very first thing on when you turn on a brand new phone. It's like, hey, would you like our curated experience that we've worked really hard to put together? Or do you just want plain vanilla Android? And I'm like, yes.
Yeah, well, that's what was so interesting about, the Essential phone, right? Is they were going to, run Android 7.1.1 Nougat. It was going to be clean, stock, bare bones Android, a titanium body, ceramic on the back. Gorilla Glass 5 on the front, as somebody who, has broken a staggering number of phones you know, I was pretty excited about that. I'm curious, you know, it's always frustrating to see something not ship on time, and hopefully it will show up sooner rather than later. Man, I can't find any, any solid information.
I'll throw a shout out to XDA Developers website, by the way. Google that action and look up your specific phone. If you have an older phone that's stuck on a particular version of Android and you're comfortable with totally blowing out the whole software and redoing it with a fresh OS or an updated OS, it might not be as hard as you think it is to do. Sometimes it's just simply time consuming and having to apply several updates to get there.
What's worth checking out is Lineage OS, which is the replacement for kind of what a fork from CyanogenMod.
I miss those days, so, man. I miss being able to load up the latest version of CyanogenMod back in the day on an unlocked phone. You'd have the latest features and some other really cool stuff right there without a lot of overhead or bloat. The lack of bloat, that is all I ask for.
Cool. Lineage OS, man. You got to get that. You will be very,
I have
very
no control over the bootloader on any phone anymore, at least unless you're very adventurous. More adventurous than I am. If you can't grab the bootloader by the throat, you really don't have control of that phone. So
sounds so rude to say it that way.
It really does.
Something interesting came out from Token, and Gadget's got a nice write-up on this. It's a biometric ring that could replace your passwords, your cards, and your keys. Got support from MasterCard, Microsoft, Visa, and HID, who's if you have some sort of identification system or card or thing that lets you into your office building, it's probably HID, or it runs on patents from HID. There's a fingerprint sensor on the inside of the token ring. Quote, it can confirm that you're the authorized user, then you slide on the ring, and an onboard IR optical sensor makes sure the device is still on your finger. In case you're thinking about, you know, cutting my finger off and taking my token ring. Sherilyn Lowe wrote this up for Engadget. It's an interesting read. It's an interesting project because, you know, it's FIDO. Token is FIDO U2F, which means, you can actually use it like a Yubico two-factor authentication key. Very, very curious to see this when it ships. You know, it looks a little big, and that's from the guy with the giant hands and the giant wedding ring, the big fat wedding ring. So it might not be the most stylish option out there, but it looks like it's probably going to make your fingers look really slim. Token's also working as a payment card for basically municipal transit systems. In 2017, Chicago, Salt Lake City, Miami, Philadelphia, and then New York in 2018, although it may take longer than that. It's an interesting idea. I'm very, very curious to see how well it fits, how well it works, what kind of battery life you get out of it in the real world. It's exciting, right? You know, they're $100 each. $399 is a kit bundled with the basic flavor of the ring. But basically, you're spending like $249 for the ring. The more premium 14-karat rose gold and black rhodium versions cost $299, reports Ms. Lowe. And I'm curious. It's an interesting product. And it's kind of the idea that you can take a step beyond using your phone or carrying around a YubiKey. I'm excited to have another option for two-factor authentication.
I like that. I'll be perfectly honest. I do not use 2FA for anything. I'm more about creating just amazingly crazy passwords and logins for everything and randomizing it to no end. I've ran into previous issues with two-factor authentication that locked me out of a device one time, and maybe I would never encounter that again, but it really did sour me to the experience one time. And I was like, what's the point of this? If I have a password I don't know, it uses every character set on the planet, and there's no way, even if it's stolen, it's unique. It's just like, whatever. That's a tough one. I like the idea of authentication, but I'm not willing to wear a piece of jewelry for it, considering that I do far more with my phone currently in terms of authenticating, password management, even in terms of transactions. If that were possible to maybe authenticate purchase transactions, like the way my Samsung phone is able to replicate a magnetic swipe of a credit card just by holding it near a swiping device, that saved my ass a couple times. And whether or not that's secure or not, I could care less. All I knew is I forgot my credit card, but I had my phone in my hand and it could actually recreate that swipe on a machine that wouldn't otherwise accept a touch pay or of any kind. And that did freak out the merchant. They were like, "What are you doing?" And it's like, that ain't going to, oh, that did work. I'm like, hey, I am just as impressed. I love the wipe.
Oh my goodness. Anyway. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we are about out of hardware news. We expect Ryan Trout to be back next week after his sojourn this week. You can find more of Robert Heron at heronfidelity.com. Nothing but the finest in television and home theater writing there. It's a good place to find reviews, tips, and all sorts of useful information. Robert and I host a podcast called AV Excel. It's avxl.com is the place to find it, or search on your favorite podcaster for AV Excel. And, of course, you can find me on TechThing, where I will be reviewing a new all-in-one PC next week, and we went a little crazy on the Amazon Echo show this week, and did a little conversation about how to speed up your VPN. So hopefully you'll join us on TechThing if you get a chance, and join Robert and I on AVXL. With that, ladies and gentlemen, yeah, I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Heron.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.